overtaxing students or blunting their natural abilities through too much schoolwork. The reformers, Gold writes, strove for ways to reduce time spent studying because long periods of respite could save the mind from injury. Hence the elimination of Saturday classes, the shortening of the school day, and the lengthening of vacation, all of which occurred over the course of the 19th century. Teachers were cautioned that when students are required to study, their bodies should not be exhausted by long confinement, nor their minds bewildered by prolonged application. Rest also presented particular opportunities for strengthening cognitive and analytical skills. As one contributor to the Massachusetts teacher suggested, it is when thus relieved from the state of tension belonging to actual study that boys and girls, as well as men and women, acquire the habit of thought and reflection and of forming their own conclusions independently of what they are taught and the authority of others. This idea that effort must be balanced by rest could not be more different from Asian notions about study and work, of course. But then again, the Asian worldview was shaped by the rice paddy. In the Pearl River Delta, the rice farmer planted two and sometimes three crops a year. The land was fallow only briefly. In fact, one of the singular features of rice cultivation is that because of the nutrients carried by the water used in irrigation, the more a plot of land is cultivated, the more fertile it gets. But in Western agriculture, the opposite is true. Unless a field is left fallow every few years, the soil becomes exhausted. Every winter, fields are empty. The hard labor of spring planting and fall harvesting is followed, like clockwork, by the slower pace of summer and winter. This is the logic the reformers applied to the cultivation of young minds. We formulate new ideas by analogy, working from what we know towards what we don't, and what the reformers knew were the rhythms of the agricultural seasons. A mind must be cultivated, but not too much, lest it be exhausted. And what was the remedy for the dangers of exhaustion? The long summer vacation, a peculiar and distinctive American legacy that has had profound consequences for the learning patterns of the students of the present day. Summer vacation is a topic seldom mentioned in American educational debates. It is considered a permanent and inviolate feature of school life, like high school football or the senior prom. But let's consider a set of elementary school test score results and see if our faith in the value of long summer holidays isn't profoundly shaken. These test scores come from research led by the Johns Hopkins University sociologist Carl Alexander. Alexander tracked the progress of 650 first graders from the Baltimore public school system, looking at how they scored on a widely used math and reading skills exam called the California Achievement Test. The scores we're going to consider are for the first 5 years of elementary school, broken down by socioeconomic class, lower, middle, and high. If you look at the test score results, what you find is that the students from all three socioeconomic classes start in first grade with meaningful, but not overwhelming, differences in their knowledge and ability. The first graders from the wealthiest homes have a 32-point advantage over the first graders from the poorest homes. And by the way, first graders from poor homes in Baltimore are really poor. But by fifth grade, 4 years later, that initially modest gap between the rich and the poor has more than doubled. This achievement gap is a phenomenon that has been observed over and over again, and it provokes one of two responses. The first response is that disadvantaged kids simply don't have the same inherent ability to learn as children from more privileged backgrounds. They're not as smart. The second, slightly more optimistic conclusion is that in some way our schools are failing poor children. We simply aren't doing a good enough job of teaching them the skills they need. But here's where Alexander's study gets interesting, because it turns out that neither of those explanations ring true. The city of Baltimore didn't just give its kids the California Achievement Test at the end of every school year in June. It gave them the test in September, too, just after summer vacation ended. What Alexander realized is that the second set of test results allowed him to do a slightly different analysis. If he looked at the difference between the score a student got at the beginning of the school year in September and the score he or she got the following June, he could measure precisely how much that student learned over the school year. And if he looked at the difference between how a student scored in June and how they scored the following September, he could see how much the student learned over the course of the summer. In other words, he could figure out, at least in part, how much of the achievement gap is the result of things that happen during the school year, and how much it has to do with what happens during summer vacation. Let's start with the school year gains. That is, how many points students' test scores rise from the time they start classes in September to the time they stop in June. These results tell a completely different story from the one suggested by the full year results. The first set of test results made it look like lower-income kids were somehow failing in the classroom. But when you just look at the school year, you see that that isn't true. Over the course of 5 years of elementary school, poor kids actually outlearn the wealthiest kids 191 points to 186 points. They lag behind the middle-class kids by only a modest amount. And in fact, in 1 year, second grade, they learn more than anyone else. Now, let's see what happens if we just look at how reading scores change during summer vacation. Here again is a totally different story. In the summer after first grade, the wealthiest kids come back in September, and their reading scores have jumped more than 15 points. The poorest kids come back from the holidays, and their reading scores have dropped by almost 4 points. Poor kids may outlearn rich kids during the school year, but during the summer, they fall far behind. Now suppose we total up all the summer learning gains from first grade to fifth grade. The reading scores of the poor kids over those 4 summers go up by 0.26 points. When it comes to reading skills, poor kids, in other words, learn nothing when school is not in session. The reading scores of the rich kids over the summer holidays, by contrast, go up by a whopping 52 points. Virtually all of the advantage that wealthy students have over poor students is the result of differences in the way privileged kids learn when they are not in school. What are we seeing here? One very real possibility is that these are the educational consequences of the differences in parenting styles that we talked about in the Chris Langan chapter. Think back to Alex Williams, the 9-year-old whom Annette Leroux studied. His parents believe in concerted cultivation. He gets taken to museums and gets enrolled in special programs and goes to summer camp where he takes classes. When he's bored at home, there are plenty of books to read, and his parents see it as their responsibility to keep him actively engaged in the world around him. It's not hard to see how Alex would get better at reading and math over the summer. But not Katie Brindle, a little girl from the other side of the tracks. There is no money to send her to summer camp. She's not getting driven by her mom to special classes, and there aren't books lying around the house that she can read if she gets bored. There's probably just a television. She may still have a wonderful vacation, making new friends, playing outside, going to the movies, having the kind of carefree summer days that we all dream about. None of those things, though, will improve her math and reading skills. And every carefree summer day she spends puts her further and further behind Alex. Alex isn't necessarily smarter than Katie. He's just outlearning her. He's putting in a few solid months of learning during the summer months while she watches television and plays outside. What Alexander's work suggests is that the way in which education has been discussed in the United States is backwards. An enormous amount of time is spent talking about reducing class size, rewriting curricula, buying every student a shiny new laptop, and increasing school funding, all of which assume that there is something fundamentally wrong with the job schools are doing. But think back to that second set of statistics that showed what happened between September and June. Schools work. The only problem with school for the kids who aren't achieving is that there isn't enough of it. Alexander, in fact, has done a very simple calculation to demonstrate what would happen if the children of Baltimore went to school year-round. The answer is that poor kids and wealthy kids would, by the end of elementary school, be doing math and reading at almost the same level. Suddenly, the causes of Asian math superiority become even more obvious. Students in Asian schools don't have long summer vacations. Why would they? Cultures that believe that the route to success lies in rising before dawn 360 days a year are scarcely going to give their children 3 straight months off in the summer. The school year in the United States is, on average, about 180 days long. The South Korean school year is 220 days long. The Japanese school year is 243 days long. One of the questions asked of test takers on a recent math test given to students around the world, for example, was how many of the questions they were asked in algebra, calculus, and geometry involved subject matter that they had previously covered in class. For Japanese 12th graders, the answer was 92%. That's the value of going to school 243 days a year. You have the time to learn everything that needs to be learned and less time to unlearn it. For American 12th graders, the comparable figure was 54%. For its poorest students, America doesn't have a school problem. It has a summer vacation problem. And that's the problem the KIPP schools set out to solve. They decided to bring the lessons of the rice paddy to the American inner city. They start school at 7:25, David Levin says, of the students at the Bronx KIPP Academy. They all do a course called Thinking Skills until 7:55. They do 90 minutes of English, 90 minutes of math every day, except in fifth grade, where they do 2 hours of math a day. An hour of science, an hour of social science, an hour of music at least twice a week, and then you have an hour and 15 minutes of orchestra on top of that. Everyone does orchestra. The day goes from 7:25 until 5. After 5, there are homework clubs, detention, sports teams. There are kids here from 7:25 until 7 p.m. in the evening. If you take an average day and you take out lunch and recess, our kids are spending 50 to 60% more time learning than the traditional public school student. Levin was standing in the school's main hallway. It was lunchtime, and the students were trooping by quietly in orderly lines, all of them in their KIPP Academy shirts. Levin stopped a girl whose shirt tail was out. "Do me a favor, when you get a chance," he called out, miming a tucking-in movement. He continued, "Saturdays, they come in 9 to 1. In the summer, it's 8 to 2. By summer, Levin was referring to the fact that KIPP students do 3 extra weeks of school in July. These are, after all, precisely the kinds of lower-income kids who Alexander identified as losing ground over the long summer vacation. So KIPP's response is simply not to have a long summer vacation. "The beginning is hard," he went on. "By the end of the day, they're restless. Part of it is endurance, part of it is motivation, part of it is incentives and rewards and fun stuff, part of it is good old-fashioned discipline. You throw all of that into the stew. We talk a lot here about grit and self-control. The kids know what those words mean." Levin walked down the hall to an 8th-grade math class and stood quietly in the back. A student named Aaron was at the front of the class, working his way through a problem from the page of thinking skills exercises that all KIPP students are required to do each morning. The teacher, a ponytailed man in his 30s named Frank Corcoran, sat in a chair to the side, only occasionally jumping in to guide the discussion. It was the kind of scene repeated every day in American classrooms, with one difference. Aaron was up at the front, working on that single problem for 20 minutes. Methodically, carefully, with the participation of the class, working his way through not just the answer, but also the question of whether there was more than one way to get the answer. It was René painstakingly figuring out the concept of undefined slope all over again. What that extra time does is allow for a more relaxed atmosphere, Corcoran said after the class was over. I find that the problem with math education is the sink or swim approach. Everything is rapid fire, and the kids who get it first are the ones who are rewarded. So there comes to be a feeling that there are people who can do math and there are people who aren't math people. I think that extended amount of time gives you the chance as a teacher to explain things, and more time for the kids to sit and digest everything that's going on, to review, to do things at a much slower pace. It seems counterintuitive, but we do things at a slower pace, and as a result, we get through a lot more. There's a lot more retention, better understanding of the material. It lets me be a bit more relaxed. We have time to have games. Kids can ask any questions they want, and if I'm explaining something, I don't feel pressed for time. I can go back over material and not feel time pressure. The extra time gave Corcoran the chance to make mathematics meaningful, to let his students see the clear relationship between effort and reward. On the walls of the classroom were dozens of certificates from the New York State Regents exam testifying to first-class honors for Corcoran's students. "We had a girl in this class," Corcoran said. "She was a horrible math student in fifth grade. She cried every Saturday when we did remedial stuff. Huge tears and tears." At the memory, Corcoran got a little emotional himself. He looked down. "She just emailed us a couple weeks ago. She's in college now. She's an accounting major." The story of the miracle school that transforms losers into winners is, of course, all too familiar. It's the stuff of inspirational books and sentimental Hollywood movies. But the reality of places like KIPP is a good deal less glamorous than that. To get a sense of what 50-60% more learning time means, listen to the typical day in the life of a KIPP student. The student's name is Marita. She's an only child in a single-parent home. Her mother never went to college. The two of them share a one-bedroom apartment in the Bronx. Marita used to go to a parochial school down the street from her home until her mother heard of KIPP. "When I was in fourth grade, me and one of my other friends, Tanya, we both applied to KIPP," Marita said. "I remember Miss Owens. She interviewed me, and the way she was saying made it sound so hard I thought I was going to prison. I almost started crying. And she was like, 'If you don't want to sign this, you don't have to.' My mom was right there, so I signed it." With that, her life changed. Keep in mind, while listening to what follows, that Marita is 12 years old. "I wake up at 5:45 a.m. to get a head start," she says. "I brush my teeth, shower. I get some breakfast at school if I'm running late. Usually get yelled at because I'm taking too long. I meet my friends Diana and Steven at the bus stop, and we get the number one bus." A 5:45 wake-up is fairly typical of KIPP students, especially given the long bus and subway commutes that many have to get to school. Levin, at one point, went into a seventh-grade music class with 70 kids in it and asked for a show of hands on when the students woke up. A handful said they woke up after 6. 3/4 said they woke up before 6. And almost half said they woke up before 5:30. One classmate of Marita's, a boy named Jose, said he sometimes wakes up at 3 or 4 a.m., finishes his homework from the night before, and then goes back to sleep for a bit. Marita went on. "I leave school at 5 p.m., and if I don't lollygag around, then I will be home around 5:30. Then I say hi to my mom really quickly and start my homework. And if it's not a lot of homework that day, it will take me 2 to 3 hours, and I'll be done around 9 p.m. Or if we have essays, then I'll be done like at 10 or 10:30. Sometimes my mom makes me break for dinner. I tell her I want to go straight through, but she says I have to eat. So around 8, she makes me break for dinner for like a half hour, and then I get back to work. Then, usually after that, my mom wants to hear about school, but I have to make it quick because I have to get in bed by 11. So I get all my stuff ready, and then I get into bed. I tell her about the day and what happened, and by the time we are finished, she's on the brink of sleeping, so that's probably around 11:15. Then I go to sleep, and the next morning, we do it all over again. We're in the same room, but it's a huge bedroom, and you can split it in two. We have beds on either side. Me and my mom are very close. She spoke in the matter-of-fact way of children who have no way of knowing how unusual their situation is. She had the hours of a lawyer trying to make partner, or a medical resident. All that was missing was dark circles under her eyes and a steaming cup of coffee, except that she was too young for either. "Sometimes I don't go to sleep when I'm supposed to," Marita continued. "I go to sleep at like 12, and the next afternoon it will hit me, and I will doze off in class. But then I have to wake up because I have to get the information. I remember I was in one class, and I was dozing off, and the teacher saw me and said, 'Can I talk to you after class?' And he asked me, 'Why were you dozing off?' And I told him I went to sleep late. And he was like, 'You need to get to sleep earlier.'" This is not the life of a typical 12-year-old, nor is it what we would necessarily wish for a 12-year-old. Children, we like to believe, should have time to play and dream and sleep. Marita has responsibilities. She is being asked to make the same kind of hard choice that the Korean pilots had to make. To become a success at what they did, they had to shed some part of their own identity because the deep respect for authority that runs throughout Korean culture simply does not work in the cockpit. Marita has had to do the same because the cultural legacy she has been given does not match her circumstances either. Not when middle and upper middle class families are using weekends and summer vacations to push their children ahead. Her community does not give her what she needs. And what does she have to do? To give up her evenings and weekends and friends, all the elements of her old world, for Kip. Here is Marita again in a passage that is little short of heartbreaking. "When we first started fifth grade, I used to have contact with one of the girls from my old school. And whenever I left school on Friday, I would go to her house and stay there until my mom would get home from work. So I would be at her house and I would be doing my homework. She would never have any homework. And she would say, 'Oh my God, you stay there late.' Then she said she wanted to go to KIPP, but then she would say that KIPP is too hard and she didn't want to do it. And I would say, 'Everyone says that KIPP is hard, but once you get the hang of it, it's not really that hard.' She told me, 'It's because you're smart.' And I said, 'No, every one of us is smart.' And she was so discouraged because we stayed until 5 and we had a lot of homework, and I told her that us having a lot of homework helps us do better in class. And she told me she didn't want to hear the whole speech. All my friends are now from KIPP." But think of things from Marita's perspective. She has made a bargain with her school. She will get up at 5:45 in the morning, go in on a Saturday, and do homework until 11 at night. In return, KIPP promises it will take kids like her who are stuck in poverty and give them a chance to get out. It will get 84% of them up to or above their grade level in mathematics. On the strength of that performance, 90% of KIPP students get scholarships to private or parochial high schools instead of having to attend their own desultory high schools in the Bronx. And on the strength of that high school experience, more than 80% of KIPP graduates are now going on to college, in many cases being the first in their family to do so. How could that be a bad bargain? Everything we have learned in Outliers says that success follows a predictable course. It's not the brightest who succeed. If it were, Chris Langan would be up there with Einstein. Nor is success simply the sum of the decisions and efforts we make on our own behalf. It is, rather, a gift. The successful are those who have been given opportunities and who have had the strength and presence of mind to seize them. For hockey and soccer players born in January, it's a better shot at making the All-Star team. For the Beatles, it was Hamburg. For Bill Gates, the lucky break was being born at the right time and getting the gift of a computer terminal in junior high. Joe Flom and the founders of Wachtell, Lipton, Rosen, and Katz got multiple breaks. They were born at the right time, with the right parents, and the right ethnicity, which allowed them to practice takeover law for 20 years before the rest of the legal world caught on. And what Korean Air did when it finally turned its operations around was to give its pilots the opportunity to escape the constraints of their cultural legacy. The lesson here is very simple, but it is striking how often it is overlooked. The myth of the best and the brightest and the self-made man suggests that in order to bring out the most in human potential, we need only identify those with promise, and our work is done. We look at Bill Gates and say, in a spirit of self-congratulation, our world allowed that 13-year-old to become a fabulously successful entrepreneur. But that's the wrong lesson. Our world allowed only one 13-year-old unlimited access to a time-sharing terminal in 1968. If a million teenagers had been given the same opportunity, how many more Microsofts would we have today? When we misunderstand or ignore the real lessons of success, we squander talent. If Canada had a second hockey league for those children born in the last half of the year, it would have twice as many adult hockey stars. Now multiply that lost potential through every field and profession. The world we could have is so much richer than the world we have settled for. Merida doesn't need a brand new school, with acres of playing fields and gleaming facilities. She doesn't need a laptop, a smaller class, a teacher with a PhD, or a bigger apartment. She doesn't need a higher IQ or a mind as quick as Chris Langan's. All those things would be nice, of course, but they miss the point. Merida just needs a chance, because people in her world rarely even get one chance at true success. And look at the chance she was given. Someone brought a little bit of the rice paddy to the South Bronx and explained to her the miracle of meaningful work. Epilogue. A Jamaican story. If a progeny of young colored children is brought forth, these are emancipated. On September 9th, 1931, a young woman named Daisy Nation gave birth to twin girls. She and her husband, Donald, were school teachers in a tiny village called Harewood in the central Jamaican parish of St. Catharines. They named their daughters Faith and Joyce. When Donald was told that he had fathered twins, he sank down on his knees and gave responsibility for their lives over to God. The Nations lived in a small cottage on the grounds of Harewood's Anglican church. The schoolhouse was next door, a long, single-roomed barn of a building raised on concrete stilts. On some days, there might be as many as 300 children in the room, and on others, less than 24. The children would read out loud or recite their times tables. Writing was done on slates. Whenever possible, the classes would move outside under the mango trees. When things got out of control, Donald Nation would walk from one end of the room to the other, waving a strap from left to right as the children scrambled back to their places. He was an imposing man, quiet and dignified, and a great lover of books. In his small library were works of poetry and philosophy and novels by such writers as Somerset Maugham. Every day he would read the newspaper closely, following the course of the events around the world. In the evening, his best friend, Archdeacon Hay, the Anglican pastor who lived on the other side of the hill, would come over and sit on Donald's veranda, and together they would expound on the problems of Jamaica. Donald's wife, Daisy, was from the parish of St. Elizabeth. Her maiden name was Ford, and her father had owned a small grocery store. She was one of three sisters, and she was renowned for her beauty. At the age of 11, the twins won scholarships to a boarding school near the north coast called St. Hilda's. It was an old Anglican private school established for the daughters of English clergy, property owners, and overseers. From St. Hilda's, they applied and were accepted to University College in London. Not long afterwards, Joyce went to a 21st birthday party for a young English mathematician named Graham. He stood up to recite a poem and forgot his lines, and Joyce became embarrassed for him, even though it made no sense for her to feel embarrassed because she did not know him at all. Joyce and Graham fell in love and got married. They moved to Canada. Graham was a math professor. Joyce became a successful writer and family therapist. They had three sons and built a beautiful house on a hill, off in the countryside. Graham's last name is Gladwell. He is my father, and Joyce Gladwell is my mother. That is the story of my mother's path to success, and it isn't true. It's not a lie in the sense that the facts are made up, but it is false in the way that telling the story of Bill Gates without mentioning the computer at Lakeside is false, or accounting for Asian math prowess without going back to the rice paddies is false. It leaves out my mother's many opportunities and the importance of her cultural legacy. In 1935, for example, when my mother and her sister were four, a historian named William M. Macmillan came to visit Jamaica. He was a professor at the University of Witwatersrand in Johannesburg, South Africa. Macmillan was a man before his time. He was deeply concerned with the social problems of South Africa's black population, and he came to the Caribbean to make the same argument he had made back home in South Africa. Chief among Macmillan's concerns was Jamaica's educational system. Formal schooling, if you could call what went on in the wooden barn next door to my grandparents' house formal schooling, went only to 14 years of age. Jamaica had no public high schools or universities. Those with academic inclinations took extra classes with the head teacher in their teenage years and, with luck, made it into a teacher's college. Those with broader ambitions had to somehow find their way into a private school and from there to a university in the United States or England. But scholarships were few and far between, and the cost of private schooling prohibitive for all but a privileged few. The bridge from the primary schools to high school, Macmillan later wrote in a blistering critique of England's treatment of its colonies entitled Warning from the West Indies, is narrow and insecure. The school system did nothing for the humblest classes. He went on, if anything, these schools are a factor deepening and sharpening social distinctions. If the government did not give its people opportunities, he warned, there would be trouble. A year after Macmillan published his book, a wave of riots and unrest swept the Caribbean. 14 people were killed and 59 injured in Trinidad. 14 were killed and 47 injured in Barbados. In Jamaica, a series of violent strikes shut down the country and a state of emergency was declared. Panicked, the British government took Macmillan's prescriptions to heart and, among other reforms, proposed a series of all-island scholarships for academically minded students to go to private high schools. The scholarships began in 1941. My mother and her twin sister sat for the exam the following year. That is how they got a high school education. Had they been born 2 or 3 or 4 years earlier, they might never have gotten a full education. My mother owes the course her life took to the timing of her birth, to the rioters of 1937, and to William M. Macmillan. I described Daisy Nation, my grandmother, as renowned for her beauty, but the truth is that was a careless and condescending way to describe her. She was a force. The fact that my mother and her sister left Harewood for St. Hilda's was my grandmother's doing. My grandfather may have been an imposing and learned man, but he was an idealist and a dreamer. He buried himself in his books. If he had ambitions for his daughters, he did not have the foresight and energy to make them real. My grandmother did. St. Hilda's was her idea. Some of the wealthier families in the area sent their daughters there, and she saw what a good school meant. Her daughters did not play with the other children of the village. They read. Latin and algebra were necessary for high school, so she had her daughters tutored by Archdeacon Hay. If you'd asked her about her goals for her children, she would have said, "She wanted us out of there," my mother recalls. She didn't feel that the Jamaican context offered enough. And if the opportunity was there to go on, and you were able to take it, then to her the sky was the limit. When the results came back from the scholarship exam, only my aunt won. My mother did not. That's another fact that my first history was careless about. My mother remembers her parents standing in the doorway, talking to each other. We have no more money. They had paid the tuition for the first term and bought the uniforms and exhausted their savings. What could they do when the second term fees for my mother came due? But then again, they couldn't send one daughter and not the other. My grandmother was steadfast. She sent both and prayed. At the end of the first term, it turned out that one of the other girls at the school had won two scholarships. The second was given to my mother. When it came time to go to university, my aunt, the academic twin, won what was called a centenary scholarship. The centenary was a reference to the fact that the scholarship was established 100 years after the abolition of slavery in Jamaica. It was reserved for the graduates of public elementary schools, and, in a measure of how deeply the British felt about honoring the memory of abolition, there was a total of one centenary scholarship awarded every year for the whole island, with the prize going to the top girl and the top boy in alternating years. The year my aunt applied happened to be one of the girl years. She was lucky. My mother was not. My mother was faced with passage to England, room and board and living expenses, and tuition at the University of London. To get a sense of how daunting that figure was, the value of the centenary scholarship my aunt won was probably as much as the sum of my grandparents' annual salaries. There were no student loan programs, no banks with lines of credit for school teachers out in the countryside. If I'd asked my father, my mother says, he would have replied, "We have no money." What did Daisy do? She went to the Chinese shopkeeper in a neighboring town. Jamaica has a very large Chinese population that since the 19th century has dominated the commercial life of the island. In Jamaican parlance, a store is not a store, it's a Chinese shop. Daisy went to the Chinese shop, to Mr. Chance, and borrowed the money. No one knows how much she borrowed, although it must have been an enormous sum. And no one knows why Mr. Chance lent it to Daisy, except, of course, that she was Daisy Nation, and she paid her bills promptly, and had taught the Chance children at Harewood School. It was not always easy to be a Chinese child in a Jamaican schoolyard. The Jamaican children would taunt them. Daisy was a kindly and beloved figure, an oasis amid that hostility. Mr. Chance may have felt in her debt. Did she tell me what she was doing? I didn't even ask her, my mother remembers. It just occurred. I just applied to university and got in. I acted completely on faith that I could rely on my mother without even realizing that I was relying on my mother. Joyce Glabell owes her college education first to William M. McMillan, and then to the student at St. Hilda's who gave up her scholarship, and then to Mr. Chance, and most of all, to Daisy Nation. Daisy Nation was from the northwestern end of Jamaica. Her great-grandfather was William Ford. He was from Ireland, and he arrived in Jamaica in 1784, having bought a coffee plantation. Not long after his arrival, he bought a slave woman and took her as his concubine. He noticed her on the docks at Alligator Pond, a fishing village on the south coast. She was an Igbo tribeswoman from East Africa. They had a son who they named John. He was, in the language of the day, a mulatto. He was colored, and all of the Fords from that point on fell into Jamaica's colored class. In the American South, during that same period, it would have been highly unusual for a white landowner to have had so public a relationship with a slave. Sexual relations between blacks and whites were considered morally repugnant. Laws were passed prohibiting miscegenation, the last of which were not struck down by the U.S. Supreme Court until 1967. A plantation owner who lived openly with a slave woman would have been socially ostracized, and any offspring from the union of black and white would have been left in slavery. In Jamaica, attitudes were very different. The Caribbean in those years was little more than a massive slave colony. Blacks outnumbered whites by a factor of more than 10 to 1. There were few, if any, marriageable white women on the island, and as a result, the overwhelming majority of white men on the island had black or brown mistresses. One British plantation owner in Jamaica, who famously kept a precise diary of his sexual exploits, slept with 138 different women in his 37 years on the island, almost all of them slaves, and, one imagines, not all of them willing partners. And whites saw mulattoes, the children of those relationships, as potential allies, a buffer between them and the enormous number of slaves on the island. Mulatto women were prized as mistresses, and their children, one shade lighter in turn, moved still further up the social and economic ladder. Mulattoes rarely worked in the fields. They lived the much easier life of working in the house. They were the ones most likely to be freed. So many mulatto mistresses were left substantial fortunes in the wills of white property owners that the Jamaican legislature once passed a law capping bequests at £2,000, which at the time was an enormous sum. When a European arrives in the West Indies and gets settled or set down for any length of time, he finds it necessary to provide himself with a housekeeper or mistress, one 18th century observer wrote. The choice he has an opportunity of making is various: a black, a tawny, a mulatto, or a mestizo, one of which can be purchased for 100 or 150 sterling. If a young progeny of colored children is brought forth, these are emancipated and mostly sent by their fathers, who can afford it at the age of 3 or 4 years, to be educated in England. This is the world Daisy's great-grandfather John was born into. He was one generation removed from a slave ship, living in a country best described as an African penal colony, and he was a free man with every benefit of education. He married another mulatto, a woman who was half European and half Arawak, which is the Indian tribe indigenous to Jamaica, and had 7 children. These people, the coloreds, had a lot of status, the Jamaican sociologist Orlando Patterson says. By 1826, they had full civil liberties. In fact, they achieved full civil liberties at the same time as the Jews do in Jamaica. They could vote, do anything a white person can do, and this is within the context of what was still a slave society. Ideally, they would try to be artisans. Remember, Jamaica has sugar plantations, which are very different from the cotton plantations you find in the American South. Cotton is a predominantly agricultural pursuit. You're picking this stuff, and almost all the processing was done in Lancashire or the North. Sugar is an agro-industrial complex. You have to have the factory right there because sugar starts losing sucrose within hours of being picked. You had no choice but to have the sugar mill right there, and sugar mills require a wide range of occupations: the coopers, the boilermen, the carpenters, and a lot of those jobs were filled by colored people. It was also the case that Jamaica's English elite, unlike their counterparts in the United States, had little interest in the grand project of nation building. They wanted to make their money and go back to England. They had no desire to stay in what they considered a hostile land. So the task of building a new society, with the many opportunities it embodied, fell to the coloreds as well. By 1850, the mayor of Kingston, the Jamaican capital, was a colored person, Patterson went on. And so was the founder of the Daily Gleaner, Jamaica's major newspaper. And from very early on, they come to dominate the professional classes. The whites were involved in business or the plantation. The people who became doctors and lawyers were these colored people. These were the people running the schools. The Bishop of Kingston was a classic brown man. They weren't the economic elite, but they were the cultural elite. In the 1950s, the Jamaican Census Bureau did a breakdown of all of the lawyers in the country according to their skin tone. People who were white and light, that is, people who had some black heritage that is no longer readily apparent, made up 38.8% of the lawyers. People who were olive-skinned or light brown or dark brown made up about a third of the lawyers. People who were black made up about 5% of the lawyers, and keep in mind that blacks made up a total of 80% of the Jamaican population. Do you see the extraordinary advantage that their little bit of whiteness gave the colored minority? Having an ancestor who worked in the house and not in the fields, who got full civil rights in 1826, who was valued instead of enslaved, who got a shot at meaningful work instead of being consigned to the sugarcane fields, made all the difference in occupational success 2 and 3 generations later. Daisy Ford's ambition for her daughters did not come from nowhere, in other words. She was the inheritor of a legacy of privilege. Her older brother Rufus, with whom she went to live as a child, was a teacher and a man of learning. Her brother Carlos went to Cuba and then came back to Jamaica and opened a garment factory. Her father, Charles Ford, was a produce wholesaler. Her mother, Anne, was a Powell, the same Powells who would, 2 generations later, produce Colin Powell, another educated, upwardly mobile, colored family. Her uncle Henry owned property. Her grandfather John, the son of William Ford and his African concubine, ended up as a preacher. No less than 3 members of the extended Ford family ended up winning Rhodes scholarships. If my mother owed William M. Macmillan and the rioters of 1937 and Mr. Chance and her mother Daisy Ford, then Daisy owed Rufus and Carlos and Anne and Charles and John. My grandmother was a remarkable woman, but it is important to remember that the steady upward path upon which the Fords embarked began with a morally complicated act. William Ford looked upon my great-great-great-grandmother with desire at a slave market in Alligator Pond and purchased her. The slaves who were not so chosen had short and unhappy lives. In Jamaica, the plantation owners felt it made the most sense to extract the maximum possible effort from their human property while the property was still young, to work their slaves until they were either dead or useless, and then simply buy another round at the market. They had no trouble with the philosophical contradiction of cherishing the children they had with a slave and simultaneously thinking of slaves as property. William Thistlewood, the plantation owner who catalogued his sexual exploits, had a lifelong relationship with a slave named Fibba, who, by all accounts, he adored and who bore him a son. But to his field slaves, he was a monster, whose preferred punishment for those who tried to run away was what he called Darby's Dose. The runaway would be beaten, salt, pickle, lime juice, and bird pepper rubbed into his or her open wounds. Another slave would defecate into the mouth of the miscreant, who would then be gagged for 4 or 5 hours. It is not surprising, then, that the brown-skinned classes of Jamaica came to fetishize their lightness. It was their great advantage. They scrutinized the shade of each other's skin and played the color game as ruthlessly in the end as the whites did. If, as often happens, children are of different shades of color in a family, the Jamaican sociologist Fernando Henriquez once wrote, "The most lightly colored will be favored at the expense of the others. In adolescence and until marriage, the darker members of the family will be kept out of the way when the friends of the fair or fair members of the family are being entertained. The fair child is regarded as raising the color of the family, and nothing must be put in the way of its success, that is, in the way of a marriage which will still further raise the color status of the family. A fair person will try to sever social relations he may have with darker relatives. The darker members of a Negro family will encourage the efforts of a very fair relative to pass for white. The practices of intra-family relations lay the foundation for the public manifestation of color prejudice." My family was not immune to this. Daisy was inordinately proud of the fact her husband was lighter than she was. But that same prejudice was then turned on her. "Daisy's nice, you know," her mother-in-law would say, "but she's too dark." One of my mother's relatives, I'll call her Aunt Joan, was also well up the color totem pole. She was white and light. But she was a widow, and her husband had been what in Jamaica is called an Injun, a man with a dark complexion and straight, fine black hair, and their daughters were dark like their father. One day, after her husband had died, she was traveling on a train to visit her daughter, and she met and took an interest in a light-skinned man in the same railway car. What happened next is something that Aunt Joan told only my mother years later with the greatest of shame. When she got off the train, she walked right by her daughter, disowning her own flesh and blood, because she did not want a man so light-skinned and desirable to know that she had borne a daughter so dark. In the 1960s, my mother wrote a book about her experiences. It was entitled Brown Face Big Master, the brown face referring to herself and the big master referring in the Jamaican dialect to God. At one point, she describes a time just after my parents were married when they were living in London and my eldest brother was still a baby. They were looking for an apartment, and after a long search, my father found one in a London suburb. On the day after they moved in, however, the landlady ordered them out. "You didn't tell me your wife was Jamaican," she told my father in a rage. In her book, my mother describes her long struggle to make sense of this humiliation, to reconcile her experience with her faith. In the end, she was forced to acknowledge that anger was not an option, that as a colored Jamaican whose family had benefited for generations from the hierarchy of race, she could hardly reproach another for the impulse to divide people by the shade of their skin. As she wrote, "I complained to God in so many words. Here I was, the wounded representative of the Negro race in our struggle to be accounted free and equal with the dominating whites. And God was amused. My prayer did not ring true with him. I would try again, and then God said, 'Have you not done the same thing? Remember this one and that one, people whom you have slighted or avoided or treated less considerately than others because they were different superficially, and you were ashamed to be identified with them? Have you not been glad that you are not more colored than you are, grateful that you are not black?' My anger and hate against the landlady melted. I was no better than she was, nor worse for that matter. We were both guilty of the sin of self-regard, the pride and the exclusiveness by which we cut some people off from ourselves." It is not easy to be so honest about where we're from. It's simpler to look at Joe Flom and call him the greatest lawyer ever, even though his individual achievements are so impossibly intertwined with his ethnicity, his generation, the particulars of the garment industry, and the peculiar biases of the downtown law firms. Bill Gates could accept the title of genius and leave it at that. It takes no small degree of humility for him to look back on his life and say, "I was very lucky." And he was. The Mothers Club of Lakeside Academy bought him a computer in 1968. It is impossible for a hockey player, or Bill Joy, or Robert Oppenheimer, or any other outlier for that matter, to look down from their lofty perch and say with truthfulness, "I did this all by myself." Superstar lawyers and math whizzes and software entrepreneurs appear at first blush to lie outside ordinary experience, but they don't. They are products of history and community, of opportunity and legacy. Their success is not exceptional or mysterious. It is grounded in a web of advantages and inheritances, some deserved, some not, some earned, some just plain lucky, but all critical to making them who they are. The outlier, in the end, is not an outlier at all. My great-great-great-grandmother was bought at Alligator Pond. That act, in turn, gave her son, John Ford, the privilege of a skin color that spared him a life of slavery. The culture of possibility that Daisy Ford embraced and put to use so brilliantly on behalf of her daughters was passed on to her by the peculiarities of the West Indian social structure. And my mother's education was the product of the riots of 1937 and the industriousness of Mr. Chance. These were history's gifts to my family. And if the resources of that grocer, the fruits of those riots, the possibilities of that culture and the privileges of that skin tone had been extended to others, how many more would now live a life of fulfillment in a beautiful house high on a hill?
An interview with Malcolm Gladwell. Let's begin with outliers. What are they?
Outliers is a scientific term that scientists use to describe phenomenon that lie outside everyday experience. You know, you're used to having a bell curve, and there's a couple people at one end and most people in the middle and a couple people at the other end. And the outlier is the phenomenon or the thing that just doesn't fit into that normal expectation. The book is really about an attempt to understand those people who fall outside of our normal and everyday experience, who are so special, so exceptional, so successful that they demand a more complete explanation.
The subtitle of your book is The Story of Success. How do you put outliers together with success?
The goal of the book, or the idea behind the book, was to say, look, if we examine the lives and experiences of people who are off the charts, who are outliers, who are just at the very, very top of the pyramid, rock stars and entrepreneurs and geniuses and people like that, can we learn anything? Can we learn something that can help the rest of us be more successful, or help society design programs or policies or have ideas about how to bring the level of performance higher? So that was the notion, that there is something very useful to be learned from people whose lives and experiences fall outside the norm.
That's where you started, but where did you end up?
There is an ironic element to calling the book Outliers, because in the end, what I conclude and what I end up hoping to convince the reader of is that outliers aren't outliers. That people who seem like they're off on their own, having achieved extraordinary things, are actually very ordinary, and that they are there not because of some exceptional or heroic individual actions on their part, but because of a whole series of circumstances and environments and cultural legacies that really implicate us all. When you understand that the Beatles are the Beatles, in large part because they got some insanely lucky break in the early 60s and got sent to Hamburg to play 7 days a week, 8 hours a day for the better part of a year, it changes your understanding of the Beatles. You no longer think of them as being these kinds of one in a million musical prodigies. And you understand, actually, no, they're who they are because they got this opportunity that allowed them to work really hard. And that's a very, very different way of understanding musical genius.
Take, for example, Bill Gates. Why is the richest man in the world less special than we may think?
The Bill Gates story is actually fascinating. It's, you know, my discussion of Bill Gates ends when he graduates from high school. I'm completely uninterested in what he did in college, and more importantly, what he did once he founded this little company called Microsoft. I'm actually most interested in what happened to him when he was 13 years old. And that is, in 1968, when Bill Gates was 13, he got unlimited access to a computer terminal. Now, to put that in perspective, in 1968, most college professors in computer science did not have unlimited access to a computer terminal. There just weren't computers around, and they were so expensive and so rare, and programming was so complex that programming was something that you mastered after decades and decades. Bill Gates, at 13, gets access to not just a terminal, but a terminal outfitted with what was then this revolutionary new way of programming that allowed you to sit at the terminal and program online. And it is safe to say, and Bill Gates himself in his interview with me confirmed this, that basically no one else in the world in 1968, no other 13-year-old, no other teenager in the world in 1968 had the same kind of access to a computer that he did. And what that means is that by the time he's 17 or 18, he's had thousands, you know, 10,000 hours of practice programming. And no one else in the world his age has got that kind of experience or expertise. So when he starts his company, Microsoft, at the age of 21 or however old he was, he's way ahead of everyone else in that space. You know, he has this incredible head start. You know, he really is The rest of the world, the computer science world, was running a mile, and Bill Gates was running a half mile. And that's the reason why he is where he is today. I mean, there are other factors, obviously, that are part of that, but he had this incredibly formative experience that had nothing to do with him, that had to do with him being in the right place in the right time